We're really happy to have Father Robert with us this afternoon. He's from the Spencer Abbey, and it's located just about 30 minutes from where we are here. He's a Trappist monk, and this is from the Catholic Order. And he's actually set some here at IMS as a yogi. And his Christian perspective is really complimentary and refreshing, and I don't think I need to say much more. We're really delighted to have him here.
Well, I'm honored to be here. Look around the hall and I see two shining lights in every eyes. Experiences coming here, probably the best meditation center in the world, and sitting here for 3 months listening to probably the best meditation teacher in the world. He's very bashful. I don't say things like that in front of him. The chosen few, as you know, many as you are. So if at the end of this 7-hour lecture, you all walk away feeling a little more grateful for what you've just gotten under your belt, be a success, right? A little more grateful. Turn up the level of gratitude. And to do that, all you need to do is hold your breath just for a second and let this experience come rushing through your mind. You've spent 3 months doing exactly the opposite. And I think maybe that's a little bit why Uncle Joseph here and Sharon and the others, at the end of the retreat each year, they invite some either respectable or unrespectable members of the monastery down the road to come over and sort of offer a few comments about maybe integrating, maybe reintegrating, maybe just an opportunity to experience being grateful. All you need to do to be grateful is just get a little perspective. So let me offer a little perspective, and I'm an expert at offering perspective. First of all, I'm looking at you all from on top of a tower on a mountain 20 miles away. Underneath that tower, there's about as many people as are sitting in this hall, and we follow a practice. We're monks, contemplative monks, and we have one thing that really distinguishes us. We keep at it, not just 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years, but it's a lifetime. I've been there 35 years, something like that. It seems like less than a 3-month retreat, believe me. And it gives me some perspective on what you people are doing and who you are and what you're looking for. And from my perspective, I expect that there's going to be a lot of hungry people. A lot of hungry people in this room. A lot of people feeling empty and emptied. And maybe looking desperately for something to fill that emptiness, though you wouldn't admit it to Joseph. Because Joseph and his crowd have done a good job of, excuse me for being so disrespectful. have done a good job of isolating your practice, keeping you simple, heightening your awareness, bringing you back. Breath goes in, breath goes out. You watch it come in, you watch it go out. Watch it come in, watch it go out. Hey, that's wonderful. I got to tell somebody about this. Oh, watch it go in. believe me, I'm very familiar with that. And my familiarity with it was not in the Vipassana tradition. It is in good old Holy Roman Catholic Christian contemplative tradition. And there is one. It's pretty old. It gets camouflaged a lot. Some of us were just talking about the propensity that the almost every tradition has of immediately taking the purity of pure awareness and clustering it with all kinds of accretions. We're going to organize it. We're going to make some rules. We're going to paint some pictures. We're going to have some literature about it. We're going to tell stories about it. We're going to fight about the other people who don't believe it. And then we're going to proselytize and get some more people to come in here. And very familiar story, right? I am a Catholic, but sometimes I wonder if my Catholic devotion is equal to my devotion to the Boston Celtics. And there, I'm really devout. And I will take on anybody who mentions the Philadelphia 76ers just like that, because they're evil people. It occasionally it dawns on me that the only reason that my devotion is directed toward the Boston Celtics and not the Los Angeles Lakers is because I happen to live fairly near Boston. But that's too humiliating. I quickly suppress that. Well, our religious experience has a lot of that. But in this practice that we've been doing, in which we have tried to be very faithful to keep bringing the mind back to the simple, direct awareness, when we start to judge, don't kill the judge, just come back to it. When we start to feel good about it, don't make a picture of your feelings, just come back. And so on. Develop that ability to be present to anything. You know, almost doesn't make much difference what you focus your awareness on, as long as you do it. before long, you recognize the ability to be aware not only of your breath, but you're also able to watch with equal dispassionateness, if this faculty is getting developed, the rising thoughts, the feelings, the imaginations, the words, the whole, and there's millions of them. Tell me I'm wrong. It's inexhaustible. In the course of a minute, you could people Asia with your thoughts. And just as in Asia, there's every spectrum of human depravity and human virtue, so in the course of a minute, that whole spectrum has shown itself. And what have you done about it? Joseph says, just watch. Just watch it. The hardest thing in the world to do about it is to not to do anything about it. Because every effort of growing up has developed our ability to do something about something. That's how you get ahead. That's how you make your name. That's how you become an ego. And some of us have been really good at it. Some of us are still trying to be an ego. But we're all trained to do it, to get ahead, accomplish, separate, make divisions, capitalize, convince. And then you come along and say, just be there. You realize there's a whole range of interior faculties that you've left unused. And so we begin the long process of first creeping, then crawling, then walking on our knees, and standing on our feet, and sneaking into the hall. Hi, Barbara. And before long, we feel confident. We have another whole world that we can live in. And that's what you're here to do. So along comes this funny-looking fellow dressed in funny robes, and he says, thanks be to God. And you say, where did God come from? Where'd that come from? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. If I knew, I could cause that to happen. But, excuse me, thanks be to God. And if you're hungry enough, there's some hearts in here saying, thanks be to God. And that's it. I could leave now. It's all done. But that's the good news. That all the work that you've done and the emptying you've experienced has been assisted by no thing, by no thought, by no person, by no devotion, by nothing. thanks be to God. Now, you're almost believing in God. Doesn't sound very Catholic, does it? But in a way, it really is. I mean, not in a way, absolutely. That Uncle Jesus, the young man with the beard, remember him? He hung out in Galilee a few thousand years ago. But he was a teacher. And his teaching was extremely simple. Thanks be to God. You can be grateful to God. What for? For literally nothing. Unlimited. No limited thing loves you. Then he started telling stories about it. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. The kingdom of heaven is like a fellow who buried a treasure. The kingdom of heaven is, and on and on and on. And every now and then, to get people's attention, he'd find somebody who has cancer and say, "You're cured." Huh? But he didn't do that to everybody, just enough to keep people's attention. And he kept inviting them to leave self and all its manifestations. This wonderful, beautiful self that we have built up. He came along and invited us to lay it down. And somehow in there, he sort of parted the ways, and in walks the kingdom of heaven. Well, you know, we're all hungry to hear that. We're all hungry to hear that the unlimited is in love with us. That can't disappoint anybody. Immediately, as soon as that's entertained, the whole cluster, the whole cloud of objections begins to coalesce on top of it. And everybody has a different reaction to it. Some of us run off and try to make money with it. Others try to convert other people. We do all kinds of crazy things about it. But the experience is so utterly, unlimitedly simple. And this is the good news. They called it the gospel. But it's not new news. And there's nothing exclusive about it. You run into it everywhere you go. And everywhere you go, you run into friends and neighbors who have the same hunger. Now, I'm sure if during the course of the retreat, anybody has gone to Joseph or Sharon and said, this is all fine, but I'm going for an experience of God. He would say, forget it. Bring your mind back. Watch your breath. And that's the most wonderful thing he could do for you. That's the kindest, the sincerest thing he can do for you. Forget it. Because whatever God you're chasing after, you're going to have to let go anyways, because that's a mental image you have of God. You got to let that go. So put that over here, and this one over here, and this one over here, and watch your breath. Just do it. Just do it. And, well, some of us do it once in a while. And the emptiness comes. And as it comes, the hunger gets deeper, but your expectancy of what's going to satisfy it gets broader and broader and bigger and bigger. Now, a practical problem that you all face as your 3 months, 90 days of practice, just doing it, comes to an end, is that that hunger is going to reach out for satisfaction like a suction tube. It's going to take anything that comes in its way to fill it. Computers, newspapers, work, relationships, food, alcohol. You know as well as I do that hunger is going to seek to be fulfilled by something. And that's a tension point. Hopefully, in competition with that is the good news. The ultimate loves you. There's nothing more you can do about that than you can do about your breath. You're not going to do anything about that. But if you could possibly, for an instant, be aware of it, you would never be the same again. I have no hesitation saying that, because my conviction is that everybody in this room has had that experience. Probably beginning when you were 9 or 10 years old. How you've handled it, how I've handled it, is as different as sparrows and eagles and chickens and turkeys. Vast, gorgeous array of, what do we call it? All the animals in the environment, what do we call that? The fauna? Something like that. The biosystem, the ecosystem, the environment, all that kind of stuff. You know, it's an orchestra. That's whole orchestra is right here. But if you dare allow your awareness to focus in on that call, the pain, the suffering, samsara, all that stuff, it's just waiting. And every spiritual tradition spends a good part of the book telling you about that suffering, what it's going to do, and how epic it's going to be, and how there hasn't been anything like it so far, because it's the purifying fire. John of the Cross had this whole thing about the living flame of love, and when it burns, nothing is in the way. And when you're able to have that type of awareness, everything that comes out of the stinking morass of your interior life is horrifying. That familiar? It's horrifying, and you can't run away from it. If you are accomplished at being distracted and letting your mind wander, and you can hold it off like an anesthesia, but it only holds off so long. The spiritual practice, whatever tradition you use, will set you right in the middle of that and say to you in all kinds of language what poor old Jesus said to those 12 fishermen. Well, okay, guys, take up your cross and watch what happens. I'm going first. And that's only a symbol of human suffering. It's only a symbol. It's not the suffering. Hanging there with nails, that's not the suffering. It's only a symbol. It's a sign. It could be a four-letter word. It's a medium. It's a separating out so you'll look at it. It's a get me attention. But the real thing is the real cross, the real mandala, the mantra, is that awareness of the contrast between the cesspool out of which you are emerging and the bliss of unlimited love. That's, put those two together and every faculty you've got is going to go haywire. So we have long descriptions, long books of Job, Krishna's all his experiences and stories about this and stories about wars and stories about dragons and all symbols of what happens. But suppose I just announce that to you as my little gift for Christmas. but it's your blessing. The pain is your blessing. It's your glory. It's I hear that some people have been using the term grace. It's your grace. Grace means charis or gift. It's your gift. Thanks be to God. That's it. That's all there is to it. Thanks be to God. And when you try to get it more complicated than that, it's just you're going to have to come back and unwind it again. It's interesting that in the Christian tradition, they generally ended up winding it all down to something called Eucharist. In Greek, Eucharistia. In Latin, it was Eucharistia. In English, it comes out Thanksgiving. We just celebrated Thanksgiving Day. Do we have Thanksgiving Day here? That's really the only thing that a human being can do. Everything else is Maya. When you get right down to it, Thanksgiving is the only ultimate thing we can do. So it's a good idea. It's happiness. How are we doing? Is that still going? I had prepared a conference on Psalm 1. I don't think I'll give it. precisely because it's one of those psalms that you would never think has anything worthwhile in it. It's the first, it's like the heading of the book of Psalms. You know, do you all know what a psalm is? I forget that you people aren't all engrossed in all this. This is the Bible. And the Bible, as you know, is an utter mishmash of all kinds of literature. Just helter-skelter thrown together and put between covers and dealt out. And one of the main reasons is because it took about 1,500 years to write it. So the first guy forgot what the last guy was going to say. But that doesn't make any difference. It's like the Bhagavad Gita. They just accumulate, and you don't try to remove any contradictions. You just add one on top of the other. And somehow or other, the whole thing just breathes life. And enough people have smelled it and come away living that they say, hey, that's the book. That's the one. So in the middle of it, right about in the middle, there's a book which was really the Jewish prayer book, the Hebrew prayer book. And it's been the staple of Christian monks and Jewish monks ever since. Thomas Merton called it the bread in the wilderness. There's something about that book of Psalms that you can really just chew on it. And there's a kind of a nourishment that fills this hunger. And you can't nail it down to any one thing. They're quite disedifying in some places. Cut off their heads, kill all the babies. Really violent stuff. But still, there's a breath in it. There's a freshness to it, and there's a life to it. And if you take it from the perspective where you people are sitting right now, and read it as if somebody were trying to tell you what you know right now. Why didn't they say it like that before? Gee, I never saw anybody said it so well. But if you also, if somebody wants to has got an enemy, like the Los Angeles Lakers, I can curse them with this thing and really put them down good. I finish them off. But why don't I, just for the fun of it, disedify you all by reading Psalm 1. I'm sure most of you have heard this before. If I put my glasses on, I don't have to do it by memory. So this is the heading. It's going to set the whole tone for 150 of these prayers. Now, this is the experience of not a person, but a people. And a people whose main experience of God is the desert. Emptying. Sometimes I say what God seemed to do to the Jewish people was constantly wipe them out. And obliterate all their instinctive knee-jerk reactions to the experience of God by capitalizing on it, by organizing, telling stories that enable you to pass it on, and socializing it, literary writings about it. Immediately you start all this kinds of stuff, and of course you put it in a box, and you bury it way down in the box, and you're so happy with this box. What a great box. And then God comes along and he just kicks the box, all the kingdom come, and you start all over again with the experience. And well, this is the teaching of the God who saved Israel. Constantly teaching them by emptying them. So this book comes out of that desert experience. And the experience that they've had of trying to capitalize on it and not being able to. And in realizing that God was working on them as a whole people, just needing them and working on them. So by the time you get to 2,000 years later after Moses, time of Jesus, there was nothing anywhere around in the religious field that could come anywhere near this. These guys really had it. But this is their prayer book. And this is what they used. And this is what the monks still use. We start at 3 o'clock in the morning, we start singing these psalms from side to side. On it goes for about an hour, then we come back at 6:30 and start in all over again. Then again at 10 o'clock, and then at 12 o'clock, and then at 2, and then at 4, and then at 7. Psalms. So, somebody thinks they're worthwhile. So, starts right out. Happy the man. Now, excuse the outrageous sexual discrimination, but I told you it wasn't edifying. that was one of their social problems. They weren't quite sure that the women counted. As a matter of fact, in the early Hebrew kahal, that you only counted the men. You couldn't begin unless you had 12 men. It may still be that way. I don't know. in some cases, it is. I know, but. That was because they were also developing humanly as a patriarchal society and beginning to experience the power of a male kind of organization and warriorship. So please forgive them. God seems to. anyways, blessed the man, happy the man, who walks not in the counsel of the wicked. Dualism, right? Stands not in the Tao of sinners, the way of sinners. Sits not in the seat of cynics or scoffers. Now these are three enemies. The wicked basically is someone who will not hear, cannot be aware. The sinner is someone who hears and goes away, takes a wrong tau. And the cynics are those who not only don't hear or who hear and walk away, But they sit there and they ridicule anyone who hears. These people are not happy, says the Lord. Hey, it's a good book. What can you say?
Excuse me, getting all wrapped up in technology.
Okay, so he goes on. So, happy those who don't walk with the wicked, don't stand in the way of sinners, don't sit in the company of cynics and scoffers who just don't hear, don't believe, aren't aware, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord. Now, who tells you the law? Mother? Policeman? Well, at least somebody tells you the law who knows a better way. Okay. The law of the Lord is that good news. The unlimited loves you. That's the law. That's the sum of the law. That's the whole thing. When you get all the stories and all the rules and all the regulations and all the policies all put together, that's what it all comes down to. Uncle Jesus had that famous saying, what is the greatest commandment? Love. And that's because God loves, and God is love. Sounds outrageous. But that's because I'm sitting as a scoffer. I don't hear. I can't be aware of it. So I need more practice. So this is what he says. So, not only is his delight in the law of the Lord, but on this law, this love, he meditates and even recites it, mantras, day and night, never ceasing. That's the man who's happy. Woman, that's happiness. So this is the beginning, it's the heading of the book. And all it's saying is, start out with a dualism. Separate the wicked from the good. Make a separation. Make a distinction. And then go beyond it. That's the Christian life. Go beyond it. Don't go back into it. Don't go back into the dualism. Go beyond it. Meditate on what you hear day and night. I sound so devotional. I can't believe that. So, she, is like a tree planted by the streams of living water that yields its fruit in due season. The image of growth, of nourishment, from unseen wells of water coming at you from you know not where, welling up, and fruits just blossom everywhere. The image of paradise. The leaf does not wither, it's an evergreen tree. And Everything he does it well. Not because he's conquered it, but this nourishment is coming up from underneath. And he's able to tolerate it and meditate on it, bring his mind back to it day and night. No thing. Neither the way of scoffers, nor this one, nor that one, nor there, nor good, nor bad, nor rich, nor poor. No. Come back to it. Day and night. Great stuff. Okay. So that's Psalm 1. There's a couple of more sentences, but they say the same thing. Whew. Anybody got any observations? Want to give a talk? Questions? I don't have any answers, but that's all right. I'll repeat your question. Are they mystics around here? I'm embarrassed. How did you find that out?
Somebody mentioned that. I went through that 5 years ago, and it's just 24 hours of the most excruciating pain I've ever experienced, even worse than what happens in these retreats.
I don't agree with that. It's bad. That's bad. Good. Okay, I'd love to say something about that. Well, so was I. Is Margaret here? She remembers well. This fella sitting up here, I think his name is Houston Smith. He taught me a lesson about 10 years ago. I was doing a lot of sitting at the time, and I was also sick, flu or something. It was nothing terminal, like kidney stones. But that suffering of awareness was really starting to the cesspool. There was just no place to put it. It couldn't breathe, and I was sure that the end, if there is an end, had already come, and that hell was a thing of the past. That was an experience of a type of pain that is so helpless that the prayer of thanksgiving was sort of a petition. There was just this basic need to be saved from what I was inevitably doing to myself. And at that time, I was reading a book called Forgotten Truths. I won't tell you who wrote it. And somehow or other, that book allowed me a perspective in the midst of all this. I got somehow 3 inches away from my ego. And that book sort of put a wedge in there. And during that time, immediately afterwards, I read a passage in this naughty book called, from the book of Tobias. And it was just a prayer of gratitude in the midst of incredible sufferings that this man did. And it just, like all of a sudden the dike broke. And so I went and saw the abbot and I says, "You've got to give me permission to go find Houston Smith. I got to go thank him." Well, he says, "You'll get over it in a few days."
I hope you'll tell the rest of that story. From my standpoint, can I hear that? I was in search
of a... I only had 24 hours, but I wanted a retreat place. And I had heard of Spencer Abbey, and I found out where it was, and without reservation, I just... went. And after I entered the grounds, someone appeared. And to make a long story short because I can't be confident even now of the specifics, but this is my memory of it, that you had a waiting list. There was no room in the inn. And as we walked together, somehow I began to get the sense that this man knows who I am, and you'd never seen me, but it somehow materialized that we had had this touch with one another, even without physical presence, and the happy news is that he made room in the inn when I needed it very badly.
Strange things are happening. Well, is that a good answer to your question? I meant it precisely as that physical pain. I kind of found secondary to that. Physical pain, at least you can sit and live with it and say, "This is it." But that stuff that comes inside, there's nobody to sit. There's the you that could say, "Puh," or grin and bear it. It just isn't there. It's crushed. Well, any other questions?
I know that the Buddha didn't want his students to really spend much time thinking about this, kind of one of those issues that said would drive you crazy. But in Buddhism, there is no first cause to this thinking of life, samsara, it's beginningless. And I'm wondering what your feelings are, what the position is of, Catholic religion, of something that sounds so strange and almost ridiculous to me.
Let me see if I had the question correctly. For the Buddha's teaching, there a first cause, in as we would conceive of a succession of causes, is not only doesn't exist but don't think about it. Is that correct? And in Christianity, just goes haywire over this first cause. How do you put the two together? That's something of the koan? this is a perennial koan, really. How do I put it together? I'm comfortable with that observation. I'm comfortable with the Buddha's teachings about no first cause. I'm also comfortable about St. Thomas Aquinas in his Meditations on the Presence of God, by which he uses cause and effect as a way of thinking about God. I think therein is possibly the focus of the spotlight that helps to not answer that question, because it's an unanswerable question, but to hear the question in a way that's not discomforting. That one of the levels of our consciousness is ratio cenatio, reasoning, cause and effect awareness, logic, dualism at the level of concepts. So I know green by distinguishing it from red. I know now by distinguishing the concept from 35 years ago, history. That is all going on in my mind. And it has reality at the level at which my mind thinks causally. And there's nothing wrong with me using that apparatus to search for the way, for the Tao, for if you want to call it the first cause, which it, in a sense is saying the cause that is not a cause. Because if you limit cause to my concept of causality, you are putting a limit on the unlimited cause, and so you got a contradiction in terms anyways, and so we're not talking about anything. Better not to think about it. Enters this very wise man, old Buddha, don't think about it. And he's absolutely right. Because any thinking about it is simply reducing it to your level of thinking. And that's only an exercise of thinking. But it has a reality, just as a very good idea to, here's one. Make a statue of the Buddha, make a crucifix of Jesus, make a triangle. We're going to have the Trinity, pure concept. These are all symbols. Make a picture of a paradise, a garden. Talk about Adam and Eve, which are symbols. Talk about a law, which is a social organization. Talk about a church, which is a building or an organization. All these are good, because at some level in which we must deal with the dualistic world, these things represent going beyond that. But ultimately, when you go beyond, that's what you do. So there was an old Spanish, mean old Spanish monk called John of the Cross. And he finally, in desperation, just sat down and said, nada, which nothing, for you one language people. Nada. 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 And when you get to the top of the mountain, nada. Same, you know, it comes pretty close for a poor dualistic Spaniard to the Buddha's idea of don't think. And don't project my limited notion of being and knowing on to the unlimited. That's not an answer to your question. It's only a meditation on it. Because there are no answers to that question. St. Thomas used to have this question, how many angels sit on the head of a pin? And his answer was, that's a stupid question. And then that's a stupid answer. What do you think? Should we ask more questions? There's two hands up. We started down there. I'll come back.
My mother is a Christian whose interpretation of the Bible gives her the conviction that my practice of Buddhism will doom me to eternal hell, whereas she's going to heaven and then we'll be separated forever. This it sounds like a joke, you know, but it causes her quite a lot of pain and me some as well. And I don't seem to be able to allay her concerns on this at all. I wonder if someone who sees both sides of these traditions as you might have any recommendations. Yeah, that's right.
If indeed, thanks be to God, is thanks be to God, little pains that your mother has now and her concern about your blessedness are like the pains of brushing your teeth. Slight momentary discomfiture. But they're purifying her. And God is probably, Uncle God, you know, fashioning, I'm speaking very, very Catholic now, please forgive this. Fashioning a very exquisite cross to polish her soul and make her ready for the embrace. You also. And, you know, we're here for 20 years, 100 years, a few days. And we only do it one moment at a time. And this moment is eternity. We've got our hands on eternity. Just we kind of get distracted by projecting our ego into a tomorrow and remembering a past. But we've got our hands on it, and so is she. I think you really got to trust the fact that neither you nor she can manipulate that. It's so much bigger. So sometimes clothes don't fit. Sometimes the toothbrush is worn out. I don't like to minimize that pain. But on the other hand, from time to time, it's important to put it in perspective. She is simply showing her love for you. You know that. And vice versa, or you wouldn't ask the question. And that's, in the end, that's what it's all about. So, I'm not very good at answering questions. do we have one over here? Yeah.
Could you say something about what it means for you, this love that comes from the ultimate?
Huh. No. That's the best thing I can say. Because as soon as I start saying something, it sounds so ridiculous. But thanks be to God, That's where we began. I don't have to say anything. literally, there's nothing to be said.
What is it you feel? What are the feelings you have?
Do you know that poem, John of the Cross? Nada, 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 nada. I do the best I can when I... This sounds outrageous. When I experience just lovely feelings to bring my mind back. Because that's limiting God to what I can feel. And if that's all there is, poor God. To say nothing about me and his mother.
could you tell us a little bit about the cisterness tradition, the Trappist tradition?
Can I blow my nose first? Nothing like technology. The Buddha never had that advantage. Question is, can I say something about the Cistercian tradition? Historically, I can tell you a little bit about it. It's an extension of the first movement of the early Christians to go into the desert, to the eremitical tradition, to literally run away, seek solitude, seek emptiness, and do a practice. And generally, their practice was very similar to the Vipassana practice. It was very pure. The spirituality of the Desert Fathers, they would take one word or one sentence from the Psalms, generally, "Oh God, come to my assistance," and they'd stay with that day and night, and they'd bring their mind back, keep bringing their mind back. So that it was out of that tradition that this monastic thing came. Previous to that, there was the Jewish tradition of the Essenes. John the Baptist was one of those. This developed here, there, and everywhere, mostly in Egypt, some in Greece. Finally, it came to Rome. And there was a young fellow named Benedict who ran off into the cave and lived there for about 20 years. He was fairly educated and from a patristic Roman family, so he organized a group of people to follow this tradition using the social organization of the Roman family, the patriarchal family. So you have authority and an abbas, and he had everything all organized. You know, Romans could organize things to death. It was disgusting. But he was good at it. And they conquered the world doing that, and he indeed conquered the religious minds of Europe. And that went on very successfully for about five centuries. And with the breakup of feudal society, there was a heightened awareness of the individual, and heightened awareness of the power of a word, the written word. The Cistercians came along just at this time, and they were part of a whole tradition of back to simplicity, back to the Desert Fathers, back to the simple word, minimum organization, minimum of art, minimum of everything, kept everything simple. And at the same time, they brought with it romance. Nice, warm stuff. Right out of the mountains of Spain and France. They were troubadours, singing romantic clowns. And they were aristocrats, too, with a certain level of chivalry. So they put all that in the pot, and a group of them left a very well-established Benedictine monastery and went out into a swamp, thus the name Cistercian, because it means cistern, literally, a swamp. And they sat there, and they built some huts, drained the land. Within a century, they pretty much dominated the social life of Europe, certainly dominated the economy. They raised sheep. And developed a mystical theology that went along with this Roman organization. It was a wedding of it. So it was kind of a mixture, and there was really a flame to it, a fire to it. By its own force, like all great spiritual movements, it gathered all kinds of stuff around it, and before long it got so heavy it crashed. And you had constant reforms of it. The Trappists were a reform right after the French Revolution. Very severe people, really mean. The average lifespan was 33. It caught the imagination of France. Survived even into Napoleonic era, and gradually spread throughout the world. And now there's 12 houses in this country, South America, Africa, all forms of it, all throughout Asia, Europe, Scandinavia, so on. So I'm one of those. Yeah. You may laugh at me because my clothes are dirty. Anybody who wears these robes, you know, they should at least keep them clean, huh? But they're my clothes. So they get dirty. That's something of the flavor of the Trappist. There's a lot of austerity, romance, mysticism, regularity, and some dirty clothes. I'm one of them. I think two more questions. That wind it up. Okay. First here, and then you have to marry Joe.
We deal a lot with the concepts of karma and rebirth.
Yes.
Is there similar concepts in your practice?
Yes, yeah. I don't know which end to go at it. I'll start with that which comes closest to rebirth, reincarnation, and the need to carry with you unfinished business is the whole thing of resurrection, renewed life. Now, it took, after Jesus in Christianity, it took a different path, as it were, in the imagination from the Asian idea of the cycle, because most of Asian philosophy, in which during which all this was coming on, was based on the cycle of nature and a projecting of that on to unlimited cycles. So that transcendence means kind of moving the cycle beyond the where it's stuck. There's a certain rut that a cycle gets into. If you can make the cycle bigger, reincarnation is a good story to describe that. Basically, nobody knows. Resurrection, on the other hand, comes out of a historical-minded people who thought in linear terms of a succession of ego into the future. And so their idea of escape and transcendence had much more idea of just the missile going off into space. So their notion of unlimited life had to be life somewhere up. They were fascinated by going up. know, it's going right, going left, going up, going down. It's all going somewhere. You know, that's ridiculous. But to the imagination, because nobody had ever really been up there, the unknown, unlimited, had to be up. And also because of the struggle to stay on your feet. You know, we walk upright, we have to keep our balance. And so our constant enemy is gravity. So to think in terms of ultimate means overcoming gravity. Can you follow how that is a logical way of describing the thing? So it took that path. And Jesus had no trouble using terms of gardens and hellfires and third heavens and second heavens. And he just took the terminology that was there. So the similarity is the passage, the Tao, the way, blessed is the way, which is a journey, a change. We've been talking about it here in terms of a change from dualism to unity consciousness. But, you know, maybe 100 years from now, people say, that's as silly as going up into the third heaven, going to Jupiter. But the process by which we transcend from limitation to unlimited is similar. The stories that go with it are as different as Cecil B. DeMille's and Bambi. I don't know where I come up with some of these examples. that would be my comment on that. But there's a lot of parallels in the stories, especially the idea of karma. You gotta, in one case, you gotta work out the mistakes you made. In another case, somebody's watching you to catch you. Well, either one has its, they break down as a story. But if you dispense with both of them, somebody will come up with another one, and another one, and another one, because the truth is there. And we just, and the awareness is there. We're too gross to deal with that awareness, so we reduce it. That's my thinking about it. That the Pope probably wouldn't agree with that. Don't put that on. There's a few things we might not agree on, though I agree on most things. Mary Jo.
Well, actually, mine was one. I couldn't see who it was that had the problem with his mother, but I had dealt with something very, very similar, and there are other people in the room dealing with it. Perhaps the solution my mother and I came to might be helpful. When I was on leave from the Catholic Church, and this was very distressing to her, and I was taking up with all sorts of Eastern ways, she kept telling me she was praying for me so I wouldn't be damned and all of this. And I wound up telling her, at some point it just came, I said, hey, I can use all the help I can get, you can pray all you want, but please just don't tell God what to do. And somehow that got her through to be able to see the absolutism in her own thinking, I think. And it actually been turned into a joke for us that every time I would visit her and when we were parting, she'd say, well, I'm praying for you, Mary. And I'd say, fine, don't tell God what to do. And it even became light. So maybe.
We all need permission once in a while to straighten God out. And even Jesus had to ask for that. He says, Father, you know, please do it some other way. I don't want it this way. If there are no more questions, and I hope there aren't, Joseph is hungry. Thank you, Joseph. Do our usual 5-minute meditations, all right? Anybody got a bell?
You do.
Oh, me? All right. 3 hours later.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.